argument now in the case of Plyler against Whirlpool Corporation. Mr. Skoletsky.
Yes, thank you. May it please the Court. Your Honor, I'm Scott Skoletsky. I represent the plaintiff appellant, Alan Plyler. We are here today by virtue of the trial court's denial of our motion for a new trial. I'd like to address my argument today to two points that we raised in our petition. The first is that we believe that the trial court erred in denying the plaintiff the right to render certain lay opinions within the bounds of Federal Rule of Evidence 701. And second, we believe that the jury's verdict was against the manifest weight of the evidence. I'd like to address first the Rule 701 argument. Alan testified extensively about the fire in his house that was arose out of the microwave. And his opinions were important because they served to guide the jury toward our ultimate conclusion that it was the defective microwave that caused the fire in his house.
But what really was wrong with the instruction that he limited his testimony to his own observations?
Well,
I mean, she's spot on that instruction. He's entitled to say, you know, the burn was darker in the middle of the cabinet at the end, but he's not entitled to say the fire began in the middle and accelerated quickly to the sides. You know, one is based on his own observation and is a proper subject.
Well, and I appreciate your observation, Your Honor. The thrust of our appeal was the denial of Alan Plyler to give an opinion, which he stated at trial when he said, "I give an approximation of this." He was talking about the area that was burned, but the approximation of this is probably 8 to 12 inches. He was testifying to his observation. He was not using technical or scientific language as Rule 702 points out or Rule 701 points out. He was merely testifying to what the Fry versus the Chicago Conservation Center court called was tethered to his perception. He was there and he saw it. He was not using technological or scientific language. And his testimony prior to that was replete with opinions about the charring that he saw from the fire, the results of the fire going up, the fact that he saw the fire derive from the middle of the microwave, which was also confirmed by Officer Mortensen of the Wheaton Fire Department, who testified that where he observed most of the fire coming from. And he said that Officer Morton said, "What did you notice about the microwave oven?" "I noticed there wasn't any fire damage inside the actual microwave. The damage all seemed to come from the top, center, and rear of the microwave," which is exactly what Alan testified to. He was testifying, again, to opinions that were derived from his observation of the microwave. There was nothing that called for an expert opinion. He wasn't trying to link, and he wasn't testifying as to the link of the derivation of the fire to what we argued to the jury was the defect. He was merely throwing out to the jury the facts of what he observed. And the Fry Court, interestingly enough, said that as far as Rule 701 is concerned, the court should have allowed this testimony because it goes to weight, not admissibility. In fact, the Frye court stated that Rule 701 places great reliance on a party's ability to cross-examine an opponent's witness and present any weaknesses in the witness's testimony to the trier of fact. Rather than barring that witness from giving testimony, the Whirlpool Corporation could have easily cross-examined Allen on his ability to perceive and any knowledge he might have had about fire loss and fire damage. And Allen, in fact, testified on his direct exam that he participated in the construction of the house, that he installed the microwave, and he actually gave the jury a basis on which it could say that his opinion was coming from his perception. It certainly was not an expert or a technological argument about which he was making. I would also like to turn to the issue of the verdict being against the manifest weight of the evidence. We believe that the conjunction of Alan Plyler's testimony along with Officer Mortensen's testimony, as well as the pictorial evidence that was introduced at trial that showed the microwave itself, the damage in the microwave, and the damage throughout the house, all of that should have persuaded the jury that the only verdict could have been that the damage arose from the microwave itself. In the in many cases, the Northern District of Illinois and the Seventh Circuit has said that a verdict will be set aside as contrary to the manifest weight of the evidence only if no rational jury could have rendered the verdict. And same in the case of Staub versus Proctor Hospital, in which I believe this court reversed a trial judgment against the plaintiff. And what I'm getting at is that if we would have an irrational jury that would have carefully weighed the evidence that it heard from Officer Mortensen and from Mr. Plyler, it would have determined that the only cause of the fire was from the microwave. There was certainly no other cause presented, and the fact remains that we believe that the jury's verdict violated the standard that...
So bottom line, no reasonable jury could have believed Whirlpool's expert and concluded, for example, that a fire could only happen due to a faulty part if the microwave was both dirty and on. No reasonable jury.
We believe that a reasonable jury would have found that it was the defect in the microwave that caused the fire. Alan testified long and extensively about the fact that he attempted to keep his microwave clean, that he would clean it up after a spill.
Maybe the jury didn't believe him.
But the jury was, I believe, Your Honor, was confronted with extensive evidence about the recall of the microwave several years prior, and the microwave that Alan had that ended up causing the fire. It was in the same part, in the same area of the microwave that caused the fire.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. And if there are no further questions, I will reserve what little time I have for rebuttal.
Mr. Hostetter.
May it please the Court, my name is Mike Hostetter. I represent the Appellee Whirlpool Corporation. Whirlpool is here today asking this Court to affirm the District Court's denial of the appellant's motion for a new trial for one primary reason and three secondary ones. The primary reason is that the district court did not abuse its discretion when it ruled legally and factually the evidence presented to the jury warranted their verdict. The three secondary reasons are essentially the arguments that the appellant made to the district court and is making here to this court. The first is that the jury's verdict was somehow against the manifest weight of the evidence. That argument is simply incorrect based upon the law as well as the evidence that the jury heard. In order to overturn a verdict in favor of a party, the appellant has to show that the verdict was against the manifest weight of the evidence. In other words, it was a miscarriage of justice. It shocked the conscience. None of that was present here. The plaintiff proceeded to trial in this case on two theories, a strict liability theory and a negligence theory. For the strict liability theory, the plaintiff relied upon their theory of defect was the exact same defect that Whirlpool had recalled the microwave on several years before. In conjunction with that, he relied upon that theory of defect, and Whirlpool at the trial of this case presented uncontroverted testimony from Larry Latak, who was the director of Global Product Safety, who was the one who led this recall effort, and he said that two things had to be present. There were rare occurrences when they had recall fires, but two things had to be present. The first is that they had to have contamination in the microwave that remained unclean for a long period of time, and the second thing was that the microwave had to be on at the time of the fire. The evidence that was presented at this trial was that the plaintiff said he kept his microwave clean. In fact, he said that was one of the things he was regular about. And in fact, that was what was presented at trial. The second thing was, the plaintiff said that he had not used the microwave for about 6 or 7 hours prior to this fire. Those two facts alone render the established for us at trial that the cause of this house fire could not have been related to the same defect theory that warranted Whirlpool's recall in the first place. The second argument that they made was a negligence claim, and the argument was that Whirlpool was negligent when it conducted its recall. Again, uncontroverted evidence at trial from the director of Global Product Safety about what Whirlpool did when it discovered in the field seven fires that occurred when you had the sort of cluster of events taking place. He testified, again, uncontroverted, he went to the Consumer Product Safety Commission. In conjunction with the Consumer Product Safety Commission, Whirlpool issued a recall. It disseminated information about the recall in media outlets, newspapers, television, magazines, radio. In fact, his testimony was that 75% of the affected microwaves were reworked, and that was by a factor of five better than the average at the Consumer Product Safety Commission. In short, the evidence at trial was Whirlpool didn't just meet the standard, it was reasonable in its efforts, it exceeded that. But that doesn't have to be, that does not what Whirlpool has to show here. All we have to show is that the verdict was not something that represents a miscarriage of justice, and that's simply not the case. The second argument that they make is that somehow the district court limited the plaintiff from rendering lay opinion testimony. And in our brief, we cite this cumulative effect of the plaintiff's testimony over time. And he began not just talking about what he saw and what was evident in pictures, but describing it and interpreting it to the jury. If you see what we cited in our brief, he continually said, obviously this shows heating from, this shows high heat. This shows the flame pattern. All of that is expert testimony beyond what is envisioned by Rule 701. Rule 701 recognizes that there is an inherent inference that goes into what someone says. For instance, if an eyewitness is asked the question, was the person old or young? Well, that's going to depend in large part on the eyewitness. If the eyewitness is young, they may say they're old. If the eyewitness is old, they may say the person is young. There's a recognition that there's some inference taking place when they give that testimony. That is not what was taking place here. What the plaintiff was doing was purposefully injecting opinion that he could not get from the fire department because there was no experts designated by the plaintiff at this trial. He himself was trying to inject expert testimony into that area. The other thing is, and I think most importantly, there was no proffer. We have no proffer for this court to evaluate whether or not the excluded testimony was somehow would have somehow have made a difference and would constitute something beyond harmless error. The last argument raised was the one about the testimony about the plaintiff's divorce. For the two reasons cited by the district judge, we believe that evidence was directly relevant. One of the claims of damages that the plaintiff was seeking in this case was damaged for post-traumatic stress disorder. There was some cross-examination over the counselor who gave that diagnosis that the symptoms for post-traumatic stress disorder and major depression are very consistent. And for that reason, it was important to point out that the plaintiff was suffering from depression from a bad divorce. And therefore, there was the need to at least establish there's two potential causes for his depression. The other thing is, when asked, he said, I can't say that the divorce, that this fire didn't affect my divorce. And for that reason, I was entitled to cross-examine him and impeach him with his deposition testimony, where he's refused to answer questions about his divorce because he says, I'm not saying the two are related. And for that reason, it was relevant, and the court did reject that argument when the plaintiff sought the new trial. Simply put, there's no basis to overturn the jury's verdict. They properly considered the evidence, and on behalf of Whirlpool, we think the district court's denial of the new trial should be affirmed.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anything further, counsel?
Yes. I want to first address the issue of manifest weight of evidence. In its response brief, Whirlpool cites a case from the Western District of Arkansas that discusses the standard for manifest weight of the evidence, and it says that a court will not grant a new trial unless it is reasonably clear that prejudice or error has crept into the record or that substantial justice has not been done. That's not the standard in the Seventh Circuit. The Seventh Circuit states, and I'm quoting from the case of Pickett versus Sheridan Healthcare, it's Whitehead versus Bond that cites Pickett versus Sheridan Healthcare. The court stated that Rule 59 allows a court to order a new trial if the verdict is against the weight of the evidence, the damages are excessive, or if for other reasons the trial was not fair to the moving party. And it's our position that the manner in which the objections to Allen's opinion testimony was handled would made the trial not fair to him. Secondly, Your Honors, I want to address...
Thank you, counsel. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
The case is taken under advisement.